Hi FM, 101.9 megahertz of life.
This morning I'm doing something a little unusual in that I'm getting a colleague in sort of quick succession, and that is because this is a very issue-driven edition of Hi FM, IR show. Chris Hutton, welcome, and I want you to explain to me BHP Billiton's sudden proposal to take over Anglo-American. What do they propose to do? Why do they propose it? What's in it for them?
Thanks very much, Sarah. 2 weeks in a row. I don't think it can ever be enough being on with you. I think there's always so much to discuss and try and figure out. So greatly appreciate the platform and the opportunity. So quick sort of background, BHP Group, they put in a $39 billion opening proposal or bid for the 107-year-old Anglo-American. It looks like the main aim is Anglo's operations in Latin America, specifically in Chile and Peru, around their copper mining operations. Copper, of course, very important for everyday use now in terms of technology, but also for any countries wanting to implement and use renewable sources of energy, solar panels, wind turbines, electric vehicles, especially if companies, of course, like Tesla, very big Chinese companies, car manufacturers, who need all the copper on which they can get their hands. If this whole process is completed, this takeover, BHP would become the biggest copper miner in the world. So that would be quite a boon to them, and of course be very important for lots of strategic, security, geopolitical reasons as well. On Friday, the chairman of Anglo, Stuart Chambers, said that the proposal is opportunistic and fails to value Anglo-American prospects, and the Anglo board unanimously rejected the proposal. So this is sort of opening salvo. I think it's mainly geared and aimed towards those copper operations, but one of the conditions is that Anglo spin off and sell its shares of that are part of its South African footprint, so specifically Kumba Iron Ore, as well as Anglo-American Platinum, or AMPLATS. And I think, never mind the copper issues, that particular condition, or that condition that was made so clear in the initial proposal, to me shows that BHP, they don't particularly want to add being exposed to the risks that come with operating in South Africa, not just in the mining sector, but generally in the economy nowadays, with still the ongoing electricity and logistics issues. I know electricity has lightened a little bit, as we talked about last week. That's probably mostly due to lower maintenance being done, lower levels of maintenance. Logistics are an issue, crime, but also the policy environment. It's difficult to invest and expend real amounts of that sort of new capital you need in mining to create a bigger footprint. We talk about capital investment, and we've got presidential summits. If you don't secure the investment, if you don't make it attractive for companies to invest in your given country, they're not going to want to deal with that risk premium.
So obviously, it's really, while it's maybe very good news for Billiton in the long run, and even for Anglo-American, if they ultimately reach agreement, it's actually a really rather dire warning for South Africa for the reasons you've given. In other words, here's the apple with containing all Anglo-American's goodies, but the condition is you've got to basically chop out the rotten stuff, which is the South African interest, because South Africa really has become such an incredibly unattractive investment destination.
Especially if you look at how mining has contributed to the economy in the past, mining and manufacturing, and how that share, that contribution to GDP, has declined, especially so in the last 10 years. And indeed, in his State of the Nation address earlier this year, President Ramaphosa said that he promised that mining would quote, once again become a sunrise industry, end quote. But in February this year, Kumba announced around 500 job cuts. AMPLATS indicated in the same month that they were weighing up 3,700 job cuts. Impala Platinum, the second largest platinum producer in the world, last week Friday said that they were entering retrenchment talks that could affect 3,900 jobs. And Sibanye-Stillwater announced it was looking to cut 4,000 jobs in its South African business. So it's maybe, as has become the case with the Ramaphosa administration, you wish that reality was different from what it is. The rhetoric and the fancy words are such that it's going to be a sunrise industry. But on the other hand, you don't create an enabling environment. You don't support strong property rights. You send all the wrong sorts of signals. Mm. And then business is going to respond accordingly. It's very difficult at the moment attracting investment all around the world. The US dollar continues to strengthen. That means that developing emerging markets, investors aren't necessarily willing to put their money in and their capital in those locales. But South Africa doesn't do itself any favors in this regard. So countries like Chile, Indonesia, Brazil, India this year with their elections and their growth potential, they continue to set themselves apart from South Africa.
The sort of sad history of it is that, as you pointed out, Anglo-American has been virtually a mainstay of the economy for over 100 years. I mean, it essentially was the essence of the economy, never mind the mining industry. And it's moved offshore, it's shrunk. So that history that Anglo was so tied into, so much of the history of this country, is basically whittling away virtually to nothing. And what you talk about, sort of Ramaphosa saying that it's a sunrise industry, it's not a sunrise industry. It's not. Anglo itself is symptomatic of the fact that the sun is setting in many respects in mining in general. And it's almost a perfect metaphor for what is happening, for the way this economy has been run and managed by an ANC-led government.
I mean, it really points to a lack of acknowledging and dealing with advances in economic complexity, and how if your economy, as South Africa's, but many others, were focused on extracting raw materials, at some point you need to realize these things need to shift where you add value, you're beneficiating, you're not just exporting raw materials, but importing final manufactured complex goods, which in and of itself increases inflation, it increases costs when you're just reliant on those things in terms of imports. Mm-hmm. It doesn't add to the sort of vibrancy of your economy, and then it doesn't really set you up, I think, in a strong way going forward. Let's, you know, with finite resources, let's assume everything else in South Africa was fine, strong property rights, mining, cadastre that works well, you can get your licenses, your permits. Those resources are finite. What's your step? What are your plans after that? To move away from more low skilled industries and sectors and to add value and complexity, education, training. I think it's indicative of maybe the lack of ambition and imagination on the part of the governing party over the last 30 years. It's one thing to have those natural resources and to benefit from commodity booms. The last time was before the COVID-19 pandemic in 2008, 2009. Around those few years, South Africa also benefited from a commodities boom, and you've got added tax revenues, and then you build up a bigger welfare state and bigger SOEs that don't need to adhere to market forces and don't function well. Yeah. And those issues and cracks are then eventually exposed. I think if you just try and run your economy on things like mining and agriculture, it's not to say they shouldn't play important parts and they can't be more developed and become more complex. But again, are you encouraging investment, skills sharing, protecting intellectual property rights, boosting those trade relationships that you have with more advanced economies to add those skills in terms of your own workforce? I think there's a big hole there in South Africa in that regard.
In fact, this was underlined by a piece written by, or an interview done with, Neil Froneman, the CEO of Sibanye-Stillwater, is probably one of the most successful CEOs in the large mining industry. And he says the drop in the platinum price, and Stillwater, Sibanye is in platinum and in gold, and so not an area BHP Billiton would necessarily be interested in. But while acknowledging that the state of the industry and the necessity to retrench, which obviously has huge knock-on effects both with regard to the people that the miners themselves support and the small industry that supports the mines that they work in, but he's saying, you know, things are just so bad, logistics, trains, ports, etc., and as you've already mentioned, the sort of legislative and administrative environment that the government has put us in, that there is no, there's very little about South African mining that would make a period, an uptick in the price of platinum that attractive to anyone looking to invest in areas like platinum and gold.
Absolutely. I think you can think of investment at the moment, as I mentioned, that global risk off environment, which means investors are more wary of countries with higher risk premiums, and also they seek safe havens. So things like the US dollar, for example, and it looks like the longer the Fed keeps interest rates high, the dollar will remain relatively strong. That, of course, impacts on the Rand as well. But just on Frohnemann specifically, and talking about the sort of signals you send in that global environment, if you raise the pain threshold for investment, then I think companies like BHP and others, they're just going to go elsewhere. They might then hold off on their capital. They want to invest in South Africa for some reasons, but you increase that pain threshold ever higher and higher. You notch it by various things, policies, legislation, talking about how is the government going to look after the elections, not building that trust in institutions, for example. Maybe there shouldn't be so much conversation on what coalition it's going to be. There should be so much proof and belief in the institutions of the country that it doesn't matter who happens to sit in the union buildings. You've built up the institutions, the integrity, et cetera, et cetera. When you raise that pain threshold, then people are going to look elsewhere. I mean, Frohnemann, in his interview with the Business Times, he said, and I quote, if investors are going to be constantly threatened with expropriation without compensation and nationalization of mines, they're just not going to invest. It doesn't matter what systems you put in place, end quote. I think that summarizes it very well. And credit to Frohnemann. I know he's quite focused in one of the work streams with government, specifically around crime. And it appears that Sibanye is making progress in that regard to try and fix some of the low-hanging fruit there with crime specifically. But if they don't get buy-in from government, these things take a very long time to turn around. And do you get that investment and that capital formation back? So once you've made it so painful and difficult for investors to come here, companies like BHP thinking it's not worth the pain, how do you change that narrative over the long term, if indeed it can be changed? I think it's assumed there will always be capital going around, there'll be infrastructure, things will be invested in. Not if you don't create the right conditions for that sort of thing.
It seems to be very much a feature of the ANC. Two things: ideologically being stuck with the idea of the command economy of the socialist state, which generally proven to be a failure on the one hand, and on the other hand, and something that that Frohnemann alludes to, and that is that the government has got to trust and moreover respect business. And it's that gap, that sort of unbridgeable gap between the 19th century and the 21st century that unable to get beyond.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, here comes in the buzzword sort of around pragmatism. I think it goes a bit deeper than that. It's not adopting policies and wanting transparency and sort of policy certainty for the sake thereof and being pragmatic and, you know, playing different sides in geopolitics. It's about still being principled and ideologically driven, perhaps, but the right sort of ideas, the right policies, and understanding what underpins the right policies. If you're going to want to attract investment, you need to understand why property rights are important, for example, for economic freedom and economic progress. You need to understand why intellectual property rights are also important, why the rule of law, freedom of speech. Not that these are nice to haves or, you know, it's sort of a grabbing out of a box things that might work or not, and we hope that they somehow stick together. But it's understanding how they all work together, why some are necessary, why some are sufficient conditions, all that sort of thing. I think at the moment, largely for the ANC, it's also a case of building up the system of cadre deployment and patronage networks where it benefits you if you've got the right political connections. But then, of course, you owe those who managed to get you into those positions, got you those contracts at SOEs, got you into the public sector workforce to whom you owe your living, your job, because there just isn't much in the rest of the sort of free economy. Then you create, I think, powerful incentives for things not to change and to sort of stay the same. And that's for pure sort of self-enrichment, I guess, egotistical reasons.
I mean, it's quite interesting because, Peru is hardly the idea of a sort of big, robust democracy. Its politics is very fragile and often violent. Corruption is an issue in Peru, and yet Billiton's aims is to get access to copper mining in Peru. So they've got to be doing something a bit better than we are to be attractive, and yet we're not, and while we're not.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I go back to the pain threshold point. where perhaps Peru or Chile, some other countries where BHP is looking at, of course, that in those cases, it's through Anglo, but they might be looking at other places through other companies, where not everything is perfect. They're not number one on the Fraser Institute's rankings of economic freedom or anything like that, but they're trending in a more positive direction. So the sort of sentiment, the idea of reform, of change, some elements might be stronger than others. But generally, you're going to want to operate in an environment where there's the level of security, where your police, your army functions somewhat well, where discussions around state failure aren't almost a daily occurrence, as they have become in South Africa, where in the biggest city, the most economically powerful city on the continent, Johannesburg, there's water outages that sort of ramp up on a daily basis. I mean, what does that tell you about the maintenance of basic infrastructure, where the number of private security officers by far exceeds the number of police officers of the South African police service? It's all about, you know, fairly or unfairly, that's the narrative that has taken hold. And again, how do you shift that? How do you improve upon that? There are opportunities for that sort of thing, but I don't know if there's always the saying, you know, there's no political will. I don't know if I agree with you. I don't know if there's political incentive, if there's incentive to break up the current sort of relationships, the backroom dealings, all that sort of thing. The will is there. It's just geared towards benefiting those with the necessary connections.
Finally, Chris, just, you know, the ANC is desperate not to reveal the contents of its cadre deployment policy and the meetings that took place around the placing of people in SOEs and other areas of government. And yet they've, you know, Ramaphosa himself said at the Zondo Commission, you know, that it's a core policy. It has intended to benefit previously disadvantaged, particularly Black South Africans. You can't speak out of the, you know, both sides of your mouth at the same time. If it's beneficial, who's it beneficial to, and why is it being pursued, and why is the release of the information being fought so hard? Because maybe it's a bad policy?
Yeah, 100%. Again, the proof is in the pudding, or rather, the proof is in the eating of the pudding. So I definitely agree with you there on who does it ultimately benefit. South Africa's education, public education sector, look at healthcare, where there's ample resources, but the most of it is sort of wasted and goes to corrupt ends. And then the justification is we need the NHI because the private sector has most of the resources. In public sector education, look how much money the private sector has. No wonder they've got better outcomes. But let's not talk about how we've mismanaged schools pretty much in every province around the country. So it benefits those, I think, not necessarily at the top, but those who also support them within the ANC, within the party, to try and get the average person to feel the only thing that they can get from cradle to grave is what the government can provide for them. And then ultimately, that's sort of how you exert control.
So the ANC basically is doing that work, that most terrible of things, and that is trying increasingly to reduce the agency of the individual. So if you believe in self-improvement, in your own agency, you know how to vote in the election. Who's going to win the election?
Well, I think South Africa is going to win, but I'll say that over the next 100 years, because I do think it is, it's a, the current pain and hopefully the results, while they won't be pretty in the short term, will hopefully be the right thing for the country's democracy over the long term. Of course, depending on what businesses, civil society, religious institutions, all of those do with the current changes, where it's going to be more uncertainty around which coalition it's going to be. But hopefully within that, it means the parliamentarians sort of fight with each other, and then the rest of us can actually implement solutions and things that are to mutual benefit. In terms of this particular election, I'll put money on an ANC below 50% at the moment, I think between 45%. And 50%, but let's see how the rest of it shakes out.
That's about as much of a prognostication as anyone could probably safely offer. Chris, thank you very, very much. Life, you know, just becomes more exciting every day, positively or negatively. It's going to take time, but maybe, who knows? We're a gutsy country, let's put it that way. Thank you very much.
Thank you.